This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Philip Roth, first became known in the late 50s and in the 60s for writing a new kind of story about Jewish identity. In books like Portnoy's Complaint and Goodbye Columbus, he wrote comically about Jewish young men who were alienated from their culture and families. In the 1990s and early 2000s, at a stage later in life when many writers' best works are behind them, he wrote an amazing trilogy connected to historical events, blacklisting, the Vietnam War, and World War II. Recently, he's written several short novels about the physical indignities of aging. I think he's won every literary award with the exception of the Nobel. His new novel, Nemesis, is set during the polio epidemic in 1940s Newark, New Jersey, where Roth grew up. The main character, Bucky Cantor, is a 23-year-old playground director who is revered by the kids for keeping bullies at bay. But the bigger danger is the spread of polio, which begins taking the lives of some of the children. This is something Bucky has no power to stop. In fact, he fears getting the disease. Since no one knows how the disease is spread, people grow suspicious of everything, including mosquitoes, swimming pools, hot dog stands, and people from other neighborhoods. Here's a short reading.
We were warned not to use public toilets or public drinking fountains or to swig a drink out of someone else's soda pop bottle or to get a chill or to play with strangers or to borrow books from the public library or to talk on a public payphone or to buy food from a street vendor, or to eat until we had cleaned our hands thoroughly with soap and water. We were to wash all fruit and vegetables before we ate them, and we were to keep our distance from anyone who looked sick or complained of any of polio's telltale symptoms.
That's Philip Roth reading from his new novel, Nemesis. Welcome back, Philip Roth. It's a pleasure to talk with you again. Did you grow up with these kinds of precautions? Because I think you're probably born about the same time as the children in your novel were, the children who are in this playground.
Yes, I was born in 1933, and polio became a menace in America really in the 20th century, strangely, and then it seemed to grow decade by decade. So by the time I was a kid, I was in full swing. And yes, we were prohibited from doing lots of things. And the parents, generally speaking, were more frightened of the disease than we kids were. And we would hear all that. We'd get frightened momentarily, and then we'd go out and play ball and forget about it. But most of us abided by the prohibitions. More than we abided by the kosher laws, you see.
Did you grow up with a fear of infection? It sounds like you didn't.
Once again, we all did, but we would forget about it once we were out of the house and playing until somebody got polio. When that happened, then the fear flared up in the children as well. In fact, in all my childhood, only one of my friends and only one person I knew got polio, a boy around the corner from me. And we all went around saying to each other, Jerry got it, Jerry got it, Jerry got it, you know. Luckily, Jerry got better and had no bad effects. But you'd read in the newspaper every night. It would be, say, 15 new cases of polio, 20 new cases of polio. And this is without even an epidemic. These were just the facts of the summer.
In several of your recent novels, you've written about the assaults against the body that aging brings. Just like how the process of aging breaks down the body, the diseases and dysfunctions that come with aging. But this new novel, Nemesis, mm-hmm. is about polio, which is killing children. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering why you wanted to write about a disease that's killing children after writing, you know, so much in the past few years about aging.
Mm-hmm. Whenever I began this book 2 years ago, let's say, I finished it about a year ago, I began it as I sometimes do with a book, which is on a yellow legal pad. I begin to write down all the subjects or historical events that I've lived through that I've not dealt with in fiction. And there's some I can write down and they're just not my subjects no matter what I do with them. But when I came to polio, it was a great revelation to me. Polio was even on the list. I never thought of it before as a subject. And then I remembered how frightening it was and how deadly it was. And I thought, okay, try to write a book about polio. So I had to figure out who was the central character and what happened to him.
So it strikes me that in some ways, writing Nemesis was an exercise in recovering childhood memories, because you're remembering the neighborhood you grew up in. You're remembering mm-hmm. certain smells, like I assume that you smell this, the stench of a pig farm from a nearby neighborhood.
In Secaucus, New Jersey, they had pig farms, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The memories of how polio hung over the neighborhood. So did you try to transport yourself back in time to get into the mood to write this book?
It wasn't hard. The war years as a boy are very vivid and sharp in my memory. I was born in 1933. The war started in 1941. I was 8. It ended in 1945. I was 12. Well, a child is really alive to the outside world between 8 and 12. And we had this big thing to be alive to, which was the war. The battles didn't take place in the U.S., but we had everything else. We had a mobilized country, etc. So I do know that period very well, and I didn't have to think too much about the neighborhood, because I went to that playground every day of my life and remembered it all. So what I wanted to see is, what would it have been like? Could I imagine what it would have been like had the thing we all feared happened? It isn't the first time I've done that, I realize. I did something like that on a more ambitious scale in The Plot Against America,
mm-hmm.
Charles Lindbergh, the great aviator, becomes president of the United States, and he's a fascist sympathizer, and the people in my neighborhood, which was all Jews, are terrified about what's going to happen to the Jews. So there, too, I realized imaginatively something that had not happened, but that was feared, which is, what would happen if such people came to power in America? What would happen to us? So I tried to imagine what would happen to us. The us I imagined was my own family. I wondered, how would we behave? How would my mother behave? How would my father behave? So in this book, it's similar.
So in remembering your childhood, I'm wondering if you remembered somebody like the character of Horace. And I'll read a line that describes Horace in the novel. Mm-hmm. Horace was the neighborhood's moron, a skinny man in his 30s or 40s, whose mental development had stopped at around 6, whom a psychologist would likely have categorized as an imbecile or even an idiot. And then on a hot day, you describe him as walking the streets by himself beneath the ferocity of that sun, isolated and brainless in a blazing world. It's one of my favorite sentences in the novel. But
I'm glad you pointed him out. You know, before the polio epidemic, the greatest menace in the neighborhood was Horace.
Menace, did you say?
Menace, yeah. The kids were both friendly to him and frightened of him. Yes, we did have such fellows. They happened to be two men in my neighborhood when I was a kid. I modeled Horace after a poor guy who was probably in his late 20s or early 30s, who wandered around the neighborhood all day, up and down the streets. He had a kind of goofy air about him. He was not pleasant, very attractive. He had a funny walk, kind of loped, and he had his posture wasn't great, and so on. And he wandered from one block to the other, and the only people he came in contact with were not our parents, who were all the men were off working, the women were keeping house and shopping and whatever, but the kids. And so his community, and our fellow was named Leroy, Leroy's community was the kids. And when we were playing ball up at the playground, he'd come and sit there. I don't remember his being taunted very much, but he was taunted. There were kids who taunted him. And the other kids often said, knock it off, you know. And so his life was not terrible in being with the kids. He didn't befriend us. He just hung around the edge. He was a very extremely pathetic figure.
Now, in your novel, there's a narrator telling the story. It's not first person. And the narrator is a character, But, you know, we find out who the narrator is, but not till close to the end of the novel. And I was expecting the narrator to turn out to be one of your regular narrators, and it wasn't. but I guess I was interested structurally in why you decided to do that, why you decided mm-hmm. to have the story told by a narrator. We assume it's one of the children in the playground who's telling the story, but we don't know who that person is.
Yeah, yeah. I liked the we and the our and the us in the telling. The whole community of boys is being represented, rather than if I had told the story from Bucky's point of view alone, or even from Bucky's point of view mainly. And on the other hand, I didn't want to identify the kid, because I would then have to give you his story, which I didn't want to give. I wanted to give the kids' stories only in terms of polio, and not in terms of their families and so on. So I had the we and the our and the us until about the last third of the book, when it emerges who this fellow is. I have a sentimental attachment to the opening pages of Madame Bovary. In the beginning of Madame Bovary, when they're writing about Charles Bovary, Madame Bovary's husband, writing about him as a schoolboy, the book begins with we, meaning all us schoolboys. This we describes Charles Bovary as a kid. And then on about page 8, the we disappears forever. He doesn't like come back at the end. He disappears forever. I've always liked the audacity of that and wanted to do it. And so I kind of did it here.
If you don't mind my saying your age, you're 77 now, I believe?
I don't mind.
Okay. So how does what you want out of writing changed with age in terms of subject matter, form, length?
That's a good question, which I've never thought of. I don't think it changes much, Terry, if at all. You want to be able to make the same effort you've always made. You want to be as alert and energetic at the keyboard as you always were. You want to be taken seriously, and you want to make a work of art. You want to make a work of art out of the subject of polio. How can I make it into a story? How could I give it excitement and coherence, et cetera, et cetera? So I haven't changed in what I want from writing. I think I'm more skilled than I was in the early years. But pretty much it seems to me it's all the same. It's the same struggle, I'll tell you that much. It hasn't gotten any easier, nor has it gotten any harder. It's just as hard as it always was.
But, you know, if it's so hard, why do it? Because you don't have to anymore. I mean, you've gotten the recognition. I assume you have, you know, enough money to live on. Mm-hmm. Might be a false assumption, but I'll...
Mm-mm.
For argument's sake, I'll make the assumption. Okay, so it's safe assumption.
I have
So if it's so hard, why do it?
Well, that's a question I ask myself, too. I've been doing it since 1955. So that's 55 years. It's hard to give up something you've been doing for 55 years, which has been at the center of your life, where you spend 6, 8, sometimes 10 hours a day. And I always have worked every day. And I'm kind of a maniac, you know? How could a maniac give up what he does?
And
tell me.
Is that 7 days a week, like Saturday and Sunday?
Yeah, I usually do.
That is obsessive?
Maniacal.
No,
I'd rather... Give it its right name. It's maniacal.
Why do you prefer maniacal to obsessive?
Oh, obsessive is a word everybody uses, but maniacal?
Maniacal has a very kind of demonic downside to it. Do you mean to give it that?
There's a demonic downside to this thing. You sit alone, decade after decade, and you try to imagine something out of nothing. And not just imagine it, but again, make a work of art out of it. And you do it so long that you, in a certain way, can't do anything else. Before I used maniacal, now I'd say imprisoned. You're imprisoned by this thing. You can stop, and people do stop, needless to say, especially around my age, even a little younger and certainly older, because of deficiencies, because your memory is bad. Not the memory of the past. That stays pretty whole for a long time. But the short-term memory, the word retrieval, all those things begin to become problems. And the more severe they become, then eventually you have no choice. You have to give it up. So it comes inevitably. How pleasantly or unpleasantly or horribly, I don't know.
So we were talking a little earlier about how this novel in part required a trip back to your childhood, a mental trip back to your childhood to remember the sights, smells, and sounds of the neighborhood, the fears in the neighborhood. Your main character, the playground director, his grandfather was an immigrant from Poland. And I'm wondering what you know about how your family came to the U.S. and where they came from.
I know a little. I know some, I should say. You know, the Jews of that of the next generation, that is not the immigrants, but their children, and the immigrants themselves even, Jewish immigrants, didn't want to talk about where they were from. Most of them didn't feel they belonged to where they came from, in the larger country or society they came from, and were quite content to forget the whole thing. In forgetting the whole thing, they didn't bother to tell anybody where they came from. And I think that cultural amnesia was not just peculiar to Jews, but mostly to Jews, because the Irish could go back to Ireland, the Italians could go back to Italy, but these Jews weren't going back anywhere. They left places where they weren't welcome. And so they were here to stay. So when the kids ask questions about where we come from, they say, forget about it, you know. So I know some, but not much. And what I know is largely from ship's manifests at Ellis Island as to who came and when. But
you know it from research as opposed to family stories?
Yeah, right.
So it meant enough to you to do the research? You cared enough about family history?
I was terrifically curious, yeah.
Tell me why, because I wouldn't take for granted that you would be.
Why?
Yeah.
Well, I'm curious about the people I'm with. Generally speaking, I think, and particularly curious about my the grandparents I loved, the parents I loved, but particularly the grandparents who I loved but I couldn't talk to. They spoke Yiddish, all my grandparents, and as a little tiny kid, of course, I loved them and visiting them and so on, but we couldn't have a conversation. All that was exchanged between us was emotion, which is both wonderful and not so wonderful, but it was wonderful because they're streaming emotion, but you don't know anything. And besides, most kids, people don't ask their grandparents where they come from of any immigrant group. When they die, people will say, I should have asked the question, you know. So I didn't know where they were from, but I know now that my father's family came from a little town called Kozlov in Galicia, which is about 60 or 70 miles, I think, I may be wrong, from what was then Lemberg, it is now Lvov. My mother's parents came from somewhere in the Kiev region of Russia, but I don't know any more than that. I have cousins around New Jersey on my mother's side. Maybe they know more than I do.
You know what you're saying about how Jewish immigrants of that era, because they came from a place that they could never return to and wouldn't want to return to, didn't talk about the past. I often wonder if they also didn't talk about the past because in part it was just too hard to explain, you know, to a modern American child.
I think there's another reason why they didn't talk about it, which is a painful reason. And that is, in many instances, people like my grandmother on my father's side, who was about 20 when she came here, left her mother and her sisters there. And it was very painful. And they didn't talk about it. And imagine, many of those immigrants left behind their mothers, their fathers, their brothers, and their sisters. So there was that, which they lived with, I suspect, all their lives. I'm sure that they talked about it among themselves in Yiddish, but I didn't know it. I didn't know how many brothers or sisters my grandparents had.
Philip Roth, a pleasure to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Philip Roth's new novel is called Nemesis. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. As the son of immigrants from India, pianist and composer Vijay Iyer didn't originally see a place for himself in jazz, but he found one. Last year, his album Historicity topped many critics' Best of the Year lists, including Ben Ratliff of the New York Times. It was the album of the year on the Village Voice Critics Poll. Iyer's new album, Solo, shows his wide range of musical influences and his versatility. It includes reworkings of a Michael Jackson song and a song from West Side Story, a tribute to Sun Ra, music inspired by physics, he has a master's degree in physics, and this version of Duke Ellington's Black and Tan Fantasy. That's Vijay Iyer from his new album, Solo. Vijay, welcome to Fresh Air. Why did you want to cover the Ellington song, Black and Tan Fantasy?
Well, you know, that song has been kind of haunting me for about 20 years, at least. I think I first found it in a piano book that belonged to my sister. It was sort of an anthology of blues, boogie, woogie, and stride piano. You know, my sister was the one who actually had formal piano lessons, and so I used to kind of raid her piano bench for whatever I could find there.
Black and Tan Fantasy always sounds like a funeral march to me, and I really like the marchiness that you get from it.
Well, you know, I really went into the Harlem stride tradition, and I'm very influenced by Monk in that regard. He's somebody who pushed the envelope with that language, you know, in terms of really straddling this divide between, on the one hand, keeping this very buoyant pulse, and on the other hand, being very expressive and free, and somehow embodying all of that in one person. And the stride tradition where you're really doing one thing with your left hand and the other thing with your right, and they're very independent, you know.
You're such a good pianist. It kind of amazes me that you didn't set out to be a professional musician. Now, correct me if I have any of this wrong. You got your undergraduate degree in math and physics at Yale. Then you went to the University of California at Berkeley and got your master's in physics?
That's correct.
And your PhD in?
It was called Technology in the Arts.
So what were you expecting to do with those degrees?
during my undergraduate years, I was really interested in literature and in philosophy and in psychology and history. But I was also very much groomed for the sciences, as were many, I'd say, many people from my community. You know, I'm the son of immigrants from India. My father was a scientist. He came here in the mid-60s, along with a whole new wave of immigrants from India who had a certain technical training that was sort of, they were sort of selected for that. You know, there was a change in immigration law in the mid-60s that kind of opened the doors to people like my parents. So I was, you know, I grew up with my parents and a lot of their friends being scientists and engineers and doctors. So that was, in a way, just what I fell into. And also, it seemed like a stable thing to do. It seemed like a wise and prudent thing to do. And, you know, with immigrant cultures, stability is really the first priority, and you can't blame them for that.
I'm wondering if what you learned in math and physics applies at all to your music. And I'm thinking, I guess, specifically of a piece of yours that I'm about to play called Patterns, which is, it's pattern music. It's not really about melody. It's about, you know, repeating and slightly shifting patterns. And that's, it seems like there are, or maybe, connections to math in that.
Well, you know, I'd say that the connection to mathematics is through musical traditions. You know, I'm very influenced by the music of my heritage. You know, as I said, my parents are from India, and I've spent a good deal of time studying on my own terms and sort of coming to terms with especially Carnatic music, the South Indian classical music. You know, and particularly I'm interested in rhythmic concepts from South Indian music. And so I work with a lot of these elements in my music. And, you know, that the structures of that tradition are very mathematical, but it's in a way that is, it's an aesthetic, you know. It's not just about calculation for its own sake or something. It's actually something that pervades not just the music, but the visual art and the culture of South India.
Well, let's hear Patterns, and then we'll talk more about the Indian traditional music that has influenced you. And this is Vijay Iyer from his new album, Solo. It's his composition called Patterns. An excerpt of Vijay Iyer's composition Patterns from his new album Solo. How did you first hear jazz? Because, you know, growing up in the 80s or
yeah, 70s and 80s.
70s and 80s, yeah. I mean, jazz was no longer like a popular music that was all over the radio unless you sought it out. You weren't going to likely hear it on jukeboxes or, you know, so how did you hear it?
That's true. You know, it was hard to come by, and it's even harder still to come by nowadays than it was then. There were instances of it on TV. I remember Charles Kuralt used to have Billy Taylor kind of host a segment on Sunday morning, and I remember seeing the Modern Jazz Quartet on there. And I also remember seeing Dizzy Gillespie on Sesame Street when I was really little. And I remember seeing John Blake, the violinist, on Mr. Rogers when I was a kid.
Well, and that made an impression on you? That made you think,
it was, and especially because I remember seeing John Blake playing violin, and I was playing violin, and so I remember thinking, wow, you can do that on violin too. And of course, the whole soundtrack to a lot of those shows, like, you know, Toots Thielman played the theme to Sesame Street, and you know, Roger Calloway was the pianist on Mr. Rogers. So, like, there were gigs for pretty serious jazz artists on TV. But then also, I have to say that when I was in junior high and high school, that was around the time that Herbie Hancock's Rocket. Okay. So that hit, you know, when I was probably in eighth grade or something. And, you know, that was like this kind of bizarre intervention from a jazz musician into popular culture that that had implications, you know. So that was my first exposure to Herbie Hancock.
So if your parents were part of the first sizable wave of people from India to emigrate to the United States, that makes you part of the first sizable group of Indian Americans born here. So as somebody who was Indian American in a relatively small community, did you pick up that people were thinking, well, like, who are you to be playing this music? Like, what's your connection to it?
Well, you know, I think it's a process that reveals more and more about the listener. And, you know, we're in a very strange period, particularly in terms of how we deal with what it means to be American. And in a way, it's sort of like we're hitting this identity crisis or something. And I say we because I feel 100% American. I was born and raised here. I grew up completely immersed in American culture, you know, the music, the junk food, the movies, and so on. I mean, I grew up with Star Wars and, you know, Michael Jackson, of course, and all this kind of stuff that that's part of our generation. But, you know, I think at the same time, America has been changing, and it very much because of the immigration law change that I mentioned earlier that gave birth to my community and many other communities that helped suddenly, you know, subtly shift the overall demographics in a way that America started to look a little different. But in a way, making an album like this gives me a chance to state a case, to say, well, actually, this is who I am. You know, I, like I said, I'm influenced by Michael Jackson and by Thelonious Monk and Duke Ellington and by Andrew Hill and by my heritage as an Indian American and by a lot of things.
Your previous album, Historicity, did so well critically. It was Album of the Year in the Village Voice Critics Poll, in the Jazz Times Critics Poll. New York Times music critic Ben Ratliff named it his Album of the Year. And I want to play something from that album, and I'm going to play the your version of the Leonard Bernstein song Somewhere with a lyric that we won't hear by Stephen Sondheim. And this is, of course, from West Side Story. And you. This is like this love song, some between Tony and Maria. When they're like Romeo and Juliet types who aren't supposed to be together, but they want to be together, and they're singing that like somewhere there's a place for us. And you just your version just kind of erupts in the middle, and then there's these like pounding, descending phrases that are. They're great, but they're, I mean, they're almost violent. I mean, it's just so not in keeping with this, like, romantic, oh, someday we'll find that place for us. So talk a little bit about, like, reinterpreting this song.
Well, you know, I kind of was interested in almost intervening on that song and creating a sort of alternate reading of it that that presents some reality that's different from its original context, which, of course, is really part of the jazz tradition. I mean, the towering example being Coltrane playing My Favorite Things or, you know, or Monk playing I Should Care or Ahmad Jamal playing But Not For Me or all these, you know, where these sort of classic approaches to a pre-existing song where you somehow transform it into something that's more about you and less about the song, while still somehow retaining elements of the song. So that was basically my approach.
So here's Vijay Iyer from his album Historicity, which was released last year. And this is Bernstein's Somewhere. ¶¶ That's an excerpt of Vijay Iyer's reinterpretation of Somewhere from West Side Story. That's really great. I love those percussive descending lines that you do on that.
Thank you.
Now, your first instrument was violin. You started taking violin lessons when you were six, is it?
Three, actually.
Yikes. That's,
yes.
That's very Suzuki method, isn't it?
That's what it was.
Oh, was it really?
Yeah. And so, I mean, the benefit of that was that my ear was trained first and from very early.
Is that the method where they train your ear before they give you the instrument?
Well, before they give you notation, they train you by ear.
I see.
You
know?
So you kind of learn more by imitating the teacher.
Do you have these little toy violins or something if you're three?
Oh, yeah. You have I think I started on a 1/16th size or something. You know, my daughter is going through the same exact thing right now, which has been interesting. So I'm kind of reliving a lot of those things. It's hilarious. And
would you get her
charming.
A violin too?
Oh, yeah. It was her choice, in fact. So There must be something about it that appeals to little ones.
So at what point did you realize that violin wasn't your true love and your true love was piano?
Well, you know, they kind of proceeded. They happened at the same time. I took violin lessons until I was 18. And so it wasn't like I ever said, oh, you know, violin is not my true love or is my true love. It was actually just something that I stuck with for quite a while until I was into college. In my sophomore year in college, I think, was the last year of violin lessons, and the only reason I stopped was because I couldn't keep it up to the level that I wanted to and continue with my studies in physics at the same time. But piano, so the way it worked was because I had this early training by ear, it meant that I could actually kind of transfer that skill in some, you know, limited way to another instrument. And piano was around because my sister was taking lessons. And so I just started messing around on it and exploring and figuring things out little by little.
I'll tell you, I took piano lessons as a kid through at least junior high, maybe some of high school. And I seemed really talented for a few months, like as a child who could like play simple tunes by ear. And then it just got so hard. You know, it got so incredibly hard, like reading all this like complicated music and trying to figure out like the fingerings and how to play it without hitting wrong notes and coordinating like two hands and pedals and all of that. And so and learning like complicated chords, and it's incomprehensible to me that you can learn piano without taking lessons. Not that the lessons helped me get very far. Nevertheless, a piano is such a complicated instrument. And even just like learning chord formations on the piano, I just think it's so hard. And yet so many people seem capable of learning by ear, yourself included, and you're such an excellent player. I don't understand it.
Well, thank you for that. But what I'd say is that it took a long time and it's still ongoing. You know, I still have plenty to learn on the instrument. It's something that never ends. And particularly in dealing with a lot of the things you just named, especially with intricate, notated, gnarly music, you know, it's pretty hard. I won't deny it. And, you know, it depends on where your emphasis is. And my emphasis has been about being a pianist and composer. And so I compose things for myself to play, which means that they might be within the realm of what I can already do, or they might be just outside of it, and then I have to kind of stretch to meet it.
So not to pry into your personal finances, but since Historicity, your album from last year, was it topped so many critics' polls and individual top 10 lists, you know, by any critical standard, it was like a great album. Did it make any money for you? I mean, like, you don't have to give me figures or anything, but I'm just wondering, like, what's it like in the jazz world now to have even something that acclaimed? Does it pay?
Well, you know, what it really translates into immediately is more performing opportunities. And mm-hmm. That's sort of, in a way, it's sort of intangible, or it's hard to measure, like, oh, well, I got paid this much for making this album, because really the album brought all these opportunities to me that might not have come my way otherwise. You know, it doesn't cost a lot to make a jazz record nowadays, you know. So the fact that domestically it sold something like 7,000 copies, I think. I'm not sure, actually. But and also that it sold quite a number in Europe because of the attention it got. That, you know, that starts to pay for itself. And I start to see something coming back.
Well, I've chosen the music that we've heard so far, and sometimes to prove what a generous person I am, at the end of an interview, I'll let the performer choose a record. So is there a track you'd like to end with?
Well, you know, I had fun making the last track on the album.
That's the one dedicated to Sun Ra.
That's right. It's basically a blues that's in his honor. You know, a lot of people think about Sun Ra as this theatrical and very
kind of crazy,
elusive, kind of playful, I'd say, imaginative space cadet, literally, in the sense, you know, there's all this stuff. He kind of conjured his own mythology about being from Saturn and so forth. And I love that side of him. But at the same time, I feel like sometimes people forget that he could play some piano. And some of the most influential albums for me are these solo piano albums that he made. There's one called Monorails and Satellites, and there are a couple from the 70s that were on Paul Blais' label. And, you know, I think it's amazing. And in a way, I think it's so mysterious and so profound that people haven't really dealt with it yet. He was so far ahead of his time that we're still catching up. So this is kind of my homage to Sun Ra the pianist.
And it's called One for Blunt because his birth name is Sonny Blunt.
Yes.
Well, Vijay Iyer, thank you so much. Pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you. It's been an honor to be on the show.
Thank you. And so this is One for Blunt from Vijay Iyer's new album, Solo. Music from Vijay Iyer's new album, Solo. You can hear three tracks from it: Ellington's Black and Tan Fantasy, Michael Jackson's Human Nature, and Vijay Iyer's original Patterns on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sharrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheen, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.